जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, गोपीजनावल्लभ गिरिवरधारी, गोपीजनावल्लभ गिरिवरधारी, यशोदानंदन ब्रज जनरंजन, यशोदानंदन ब्रज जनरंजन, यमुना तीरावनाचारी, यमुना तीरावनाचारी, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, जय गोपी जनवल्लभ गिरिवरधारी, यशोदानंदन ब्रज जनरंजन, यमुना तीरावनचारी, यमुना तीरावनचारी, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राजकाचार्य अष्टोत्तर शत श्री श्रीमद हिज डिवाइन ग्रेस श्री भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी शिल प्रभुपाद की जाय, अनंत कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की जाय, ग्रंथराज श्रीमद भागवतम की जाय, ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज, ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज, ऑल ग्लोरीज टू श्री श्री गुरु एंड गौरंग। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ग्रंथराज श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 4 चैप्टर 31 टेक्स्ट 29। विदुर उवाच, सोयम् अद्य महायोगिन भवता करुणात्मना दर्शितस्तमसः पारो यत्रा किंचन गोहरिः। विदुर उवाच, सोयम् अद्य महायोगिन भवता करुणात्मना दर्शितस्तमसः पारो यत्रा किंचन गोहरिः। Ladies, please. Vidura uvacha. Vidura said, Saha, that, I am this, Adya, today, Mahayogin, O great mystic, Bhavata, by you, Karuna Atmana, most merciful, Darshitaha, I have been shown, Tamasaha, of the darkness, Paraha, the other side, Yatra, where, Akinchanagaha, approachable by the materially free, Harihi, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Sri Vidura said, O great mystic, O greatest of all devotees, by your causeless mercy I have been shown the path of liberation from this world of darkness. By following this path, a person liberated from the material world can return home back to Godhead. Purport. This material world is called Tamaha, dark. And the spiritual world is called light. The Vedas enjoin that everyone should try to get out of the darkness and go to the kingdom of light. Information of that kingdom of light can be attained through the mercy of a self-realized soul. One also has to get rid of all material desires. As soon as one frees himself from material desires and associates with a liberated person, the path back home, back to Godhead, is clear. End of purport. There are two more verses. One has a short purport, the other doesn't have a purport, and that will end the fourth canto. So I'm very eager to end it. Text number 30. Sri Shuka Uvacha. Iti anamyatam amantrya viduro gajasavyam svanam didrusho prayayo gnyatinam nirvashtasayah. Shukadeva Goswami continued, Vidura thus offered obeisances unto the great sage Maitreya and, taking his permission, started for the city of Hastinapura to see his own kinsmen, although he had no material desires. Purport. When a saintly person wants to see his kinsmen, he has no material desire to see them. He simply wants to give them some instructions so they can benefit. Vidura belonged to the royal family of the Kauravas, and although he knew that all the family members were destroyed at the Battle of Kurukshetra, he nonetheless wanted to see his elder brother Dhritarashtra to see if he could deliver Dhritarashtra from the clutches of Maya. When a great saintly person like Vidura sees his relatives, he desires only to deliver them from the clutches of Maya. Vidura thus offered his respectful obeisances to his spiritual master and departed for the city of Hastinapura, the kingdom of the Kauravas. Text 31. O King, those who hear these topics about kings who are completely surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead obtain without difficulty a long life, wealth, good reputation, good fortune, and ultimately the opportunity to return home back to Godhead. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the fourth canto, 31st chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Narada instructs the Prachetas. End of fourth canto. Fourth canto ki jai. I have here something that I thought would be nice is to get a preview of the fifth canto. So I have a summary. So as we get into fifth canto, we can be lost because it is so complicated, especially the second part where the structure of the universe is being discussed. So I thought we'll discuss a very, very high level picture, like a summary. So once we know the summary, then the details will make sense. And again, we refer back to the summary, the big picture perspective. And I'll come back to the what is big picture later. Okay. So today's verses. Although this material world has facilities for light by the sun, the moon, electricity, etc., it's considered a dark place. It is dark in two ways. One, it is physically dark. Therefore, we need a sun and a moon and electricity to provide us with light. Because when there is light, we can see things as they are. Another way it is dark is that it is made of ignorance. So although there is sun, the moon, electricity, still people are in darkness, consciousness-wise. While Krishna has made arrangement in the material world for physical darkness to be removed, at least for half the day, especially if you're living in the northern hemisphere, then it is less than half the day. Right? In winters, by 3 o'clock, it gets dark. Short days, long nights. Although physical darkness is removed, and in that daytime, things are clearer. However, consciousness-wise, the darkness still sustains, it remains. And darkness has certain characteristics. One, in darkness, we cannot see anything. We cannot grasp or fathom what we are into. We cannot traverse from one place to another place in the dark. And another feature of darkness is that there is fear. Right? When it's dark, it's fearful. How much ever doesn't matter, we have grown up, we are adults, still in the dark, there is fear. Right? We may know our house, our ashram well. We may know all the corners very well. Yet, if we are walking at night or in the dark, somehow some noise happens, some sound, and the first thing is, who's there? Because in darkness, one can get consumed. There is danger. So now, there's darkness in the consciousness. So there is fear, lamentation, anxiety. Don't know how to get from one situation to another situation of life. The only solace is that we just do what everyone else is doing. Because that's called mob mentality. Everyone is running, I'm also running. Someone will ask, why are you running? I don't know, they were running, I was also running with them. That's the only way to get out of that sense of perplexity from darkness. But in yesterday's class, Jaya Jagannath Prabhu quoted this triplet verses, in which andhayatandhai upaniyamana. What happens is because of darkness or blindness, people tend to follow blindly. So those who are leading the path are blind. Those who are following are also blind. And so two blind people, they're leading each other. Yesterday while he was speaking, I was trying to have a visual. I'm a visual person. For me, everything has to be in pictures or boxes, so it's easier for me to understand. I was actually imagining what it looks like for a blind man to follow another blind man. Like, they don't know. What does it look like? Two people just following, one following the other. They don't know where they're going. The only person who can remove this darkness, turn the light switch on, is the spiritual master. When I say spiritual master, actually it is Shastra, scripture. But scripture is not accessible without Guru. One who accesses scripture, Shastra, without Guru gets even more confused. Because scripture is not meant for any blind person to traverse into, just to delve into. There is an Upanishad called Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad. Brihad means big, Aranyaka means forest-like. So that Upanishad explains that Shastra, scripture, is like this massive forest. And we know in a massive forest where the trees have clustered so closely to each other, their branches form a canopy and usually sunlight cannot penetrate. So a dense forest is usually dark. So what it means is one may be in scripture, one may be studying scripture, but without the help of Guru, one may be lost even in that scripture. One may not know what to do. So one needs Guru to explain which aspect of scripture is most applicable to us in what circumstance of life. And we need sadhus who live that scripture to see actual examples of how philosophical or principles of life are lived. Therefore we say, Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Salakaya. That darkness can only be dissipated by knowledge, transcendental knowledge. And transcendental knowledge only exists with Guru. So it's very important. And here Vidura is expressing his gratitude for being helped out of that darkness. And out of his gratitude, he is offering obeisances to Maitreya Muni. And then he says, another aspect is, it's not sufficient that one meets a guru. In context, when one meets a guru and has the ability to receive transcendental knowledge, something the receiver has to do, has to become free of material desires. Material desires are blockages that actually don't let the light of transcendental knowledge to set in. They're actually like the contaminations. They're blockages. So although the spiritual master is giving transcendental knowledge, if the disciple does not actively work on removing material desires, that transcendental knowledge cannot hold in the heart. It'll go away. Generally, the analogy given is like of a bucket. Our heart is like a bucket. It receives Krishna's mercy. We may not have a full bucket. We may be carrying a quarter teaspoon, but that's okay. Whatever it is, our bucket is our bucket. Small size. All that we can do is use quarter teaspoon salt or something, a small bucket. But some people's buckets are bigger, half a teaspoon. Some people have 1 tablespoon. Some people have a gallon, whatever. There's a bucket. And every day the spiritual master fills that bucket with divine mercy, instructions, both vani and presence, vapu, scripture, saintly association, service. These are all ingredients that fill up the bucket. In simple language, it's called descending mercy. And depending upon what the bhakta does with the bucket during the day, decides what happens to it. So when material desires are also nurtured side by side, it is like poking holes in that bucket. For small material desires, it's a crack, little hole. For something really seriously foolish, it's like a big hole, and in some cases the bottom drops out. Even after, so then every day we seal up the bucket, at least there's a determination to seal the bucket. We come in front of Guru and say, Samsara Davanalanidaloka Tranaya Karunya Gana Ganatum. All right, fill it up. And then 5 minutes later, we poke a nice hole in it. And by the time Bhagavatam class is over, bucket is empty. I'm being extreme, but let's say during the course of the day, the bucket starts dripping and leaks out the descending mercy. So what happens is every day, although one attends Mangala Arati, chants all his rounds, every day we're starting from zero. So we start, oh, today my bucket is filled with descending mercy. By the end of the day it's gone, or depleted to a large degree. So we keep coming back, we keep getting new doses of mercy. The problem is our tendency, our habit to poke holes in that bucket has not gone away. Ideally, it should be that each day the mercy accrues from previous day, from the previous day to the next day to the next day, such that from little vessel, our heart becomes a big receiver, a big bucket. So when there is a lot of mercy and it is filled, naturally it overflows so that others can get it. But if we ourselves are not benefiting from that mercy, by the end of the day it's gone. What are we distributing to others? All we're showing others is, hey, see how good I am at poking holes. You can learn that from me. But Vidura is not like that. Vidura is, okay, so what is it about Vidura that his bucket does not have holes? What makes the bucket impervious to holes is when it is made of gratitude. Then the bucket cannot have holes in it. When the bucket is made of something other than gratitude, it can just be fashion, or others are doing it, therefore I should also accept a guru, or whatever other reasons, then that bucket is vulnerable to having many holes in it. So side by side, as one cultivates one's gratitude, the bucket becomes stronger. Then even if material desires may be there, holes don't show up. It may be dented. I don't know, here we don't have steel pots. We do have in the kitchen. But in India, everything is steel or, you know, brass or aluminium. And we used to have little lotas that we used to carry to the bathroom. And every time it would fall, it would dent. In about 6 months, the lota would have all sorts of shape other than the actual shape it's supposed to have. So it may dent, but there won't be holes in it. So without gratitude, we begin everything with Om Ajnanati Virandasya. This for this reason, we are grateful that we have been, the divine grace has descended into our hearts. Then it becomes our duty to carefully nurture it. And the best way to care for the descending mercy is to share it. Anything material, the best way to care for it is to keep it. Right? Money. If the worst thing to do with money is to spend it. That's what the government wants us to do. They want us to spend our money. Because when we spend our money, the economy gets activated. There is demand. Because there is demand, they have to create supply. That means their jobs will be there. People will get employed. And when they get employed, they'll work very hard and spend their money. But wealth is to be kept. But the real wealth is spiritual knowledge. And that should not be kept. It should be shared. When spiritual knowledge is not shared, it leaks out. Leaks out doesn't mean we meet someone and they, you know, suddenly something will come. Not like that leak out. It leaks out that at the right time, it won't be available. It's like a bhakta going on book distribution with no gas in the gas tank. Has it ever happened to anyone? Yeah, happened. Suddenly we realize, oh, no gas. Oh, I was thinking about something, although I was not hinting at that. It leaks out. So it is said that a brahmana who doesn't engage in teaching, in sharing, such a brahmana loses their spiritual wealth. It goes through inflation. Suddenly the value goes away. What was $100 at one point in time is now 50 or less. The brahmana loses his spiritual wealth by not sharing. Brahmana, actually the word is dvija. Dvija means one who has taken second birth. Humanity, a human being is considered a human being when he or she takes two births. Only one birth, one is not considered a full, is not considered a cultured human being. Because even animals take one birth, right? One first birth is from the womb of the mother. That even animals do, insects do, beasts, birds, reptiles, they also take the birth from their mother. But a human being is considered a human being when he or she takes a second birth in the same life. And that second birth is when the person becomes actual cultured human being. And that second birth is, the mother is the Vedas and the spiritual master is considered to be the father. Actually the father is Krishna and the Vedas are the mother. But said Guru is the father because he gives birth to the jiva in this life. So they are called dvija, one who have second birth. Brahmanas, Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, all are considered dvijas. Brahmanas are considered dvijashreshta, the best of the twice born. In this case, Vidura, although born in royal family, he is born from royal seed, is not necessarily actually a Kshatriya, although he is born in a royal family. Because he was born to the maid servant of Queen Ambika. And he is Dhritarashtra's half-brother. When Satyavati, Queen Satyavati, she had two sons from King Shantanu, Vichitravirya and Chitrangada. And these two were married to Ambika and Ambalika, I think. Yeah. Unfortunately, both these young princes, they died untimely. And the entire Bharata family, the Kaurava family, or Kuru dynasty, was left without an heir. So she was very concerned. Then according to non-Kali Yuga possibilities, Vyasadeva, who is also considered like to be, is the son of Satyavati, born to Parashara Muni, he was called upon a very special service to impregnate Ambika and Ambalika And this is only allowed in non-Kali Yugas. Kali Yuga, not allowed. Not allowed to have a child through one's sister-in-law. In other ages, under extenuating circumstances like this, where there is no heir for such a royal kingdom, it was allowed. So Vyasadeva was consulted and he said, yeah, we're not going to break any religious principles because it's an extenuating circumstance. And he fathered two children. One was born blind, Dhritarashtra, and the other was born very pale, Pandu. So they said, well, this is not, how can we have a blind prince? King cannot be blind. Try again. They said, well, this is not okay. No, please try one more time. He said, all right, three times and that's about it. So when he came back to Ambika, she said, whoa, last time I looked at Vyasadeva, I got scared. I had to close my eyes. That's why he was born blind. Because Vyasadeva was in the middle of austerities. His body was all smeared with ash, hair was all matted, bearded, a very, very emaciated body. And he had told her, please wait till I finish my austerities, then I'll shave up and I'll look pretty good. Satyavati said, no, I cannot wait. It has to happen now. So Ambika, she closed her eyes when she saw Vyasadeva. So this child was born blind. So when he had to try a third time, Ambika very quietly escaped the room and convinced her servant to unite with Vyasadeva instead. And the servant, she received Vyasadeva with great regard and honor, touched his feet, took the dust from his feet upon her head and served him very nicely. So the son who was born was Vidura. Now in the previous ages, kings could have children through maidservants like these. But the only rule was that those children or sons cannot inherit the kingdom. They will be given all of the facilities as if they were princes. Except they cannot claim their right to the throne. So Vidura grew up as one of the brothers of the Kauravas, Dhritarashtra and Pandu. Now Vidura has received all his instructions from Maitreya Rishi, offers him obeisances, and the first thing he wants to do is to serve those instructions. It's not like, I received transcendental knowledge. What to do? No, service. It has to be applied. So Vidura immediately thought about his older brother, Dhritarashtra. He knew that the massive fratricidal war had happened. All the Kauravas were dead except Dhritarashtra. And he knew that his brother is suffering like anything. Imagine being blind by birth, being in the royal kingdom but never could become the king. I mean, that's terrible for a Kshatriya. Then wanted his sons to inherit the kingdom, but all 100 sons died. And what was worse is that his brother's sons were the ones who killed them. And they have become the emperors, or emperor, Yudhishthir Maharaj. So he was suffering very, very, in a very distressful condition. And all of this is because of his attachment to the throne. His attachment to wanting to be the king. His attachment that his son should be the king. And Vidura wanted to relieve him of that attachment. This is kindness. When anyone wants to relieve us of our attachment, that is kindness. It's hurtful. That's why we get upset with somebody. Ouch! Why are you doing this to me? But it is necessary to remove that attachment. Because when we are attached, then we are stuck to that situation. We are stuck to that idea. And life is moving on. But we don't move. Life is presenting so many other opportunities, but we don't see them because we are attached. So the sadhu has to remove that attachment so we can move with life. So Vidura thought of Dhritarashtra. So we have read in the first canto, 13th chapter, Vidura goes and chastises Dhritarashtra, calls him really names. You're sitting here like a dog. Your teeth have fallen off. You've become so old. You're coughing mucus. And you're happy sitting at home eating little scraps that Bhima is throwing to you. That's terrible to say, because Bhima is the one who killed Duryodhana. To say that you're eating food that is thrown to you by the fellow who killed your own son. He was trying to incite within Dhritarashtra the real Kshatriya mood to walk out of that place and regain his real self-respect. They're very kind, very, very kind. So he was immediately thinking, how can I go help my brother? And he left that place and went to Hastinapura. So Prabhupada gives us a caution that when a pure devotee wants to meet his kinsmen, one shouldn't think, wow, after so many instructions, Vidura wants to go back to his family? What's wrong? Now, Vidura is going back to deliver his family from the clutches of Maya. Generally, it is said, it's difficult for a person to deliver his own family from Maya. It's difficult. Therefore, we shouldn't try it too much. It is nice that for our family, that we only behave in such a nice way. Not put on a show, but actually behave in such a nice way, humble, respectful, friendly, that they become open to hearing what is it that has transformed us. That is when something can happen. Until then, if we are preaching to our family, then they will say, who are you to tell me? I know what all you've done in your life. And now suddenly this is something new found and you're trying to teach me. It won't work. It won't work so easily. First thing is, heart should be softened. Our hearts should be softened and then their heart should be softened. Only then transcendental knowledge can enter. So that completes the fourth canto. And then we have blessings. Blessings are that one who hears these topics about these great kings. In the fourth canto, we've heard about really great kings. Dhruva Maharaj, Maharaj Uttanapada. Although he's not considered great in that sense, but he's walked out of his situation. King Anga. We heard about the anti-example, Maharaj Vena. We heard about a good example, Maharaj Prithu. And after Maharaj Prithu, we heard about how Narada Muni delivered King Prachina Varhishat, who's a descendant from Prithu Maharaj. We heard about the Prachetas. So these great kings, when we hear about them, we're also hearing about Vidura in the same storyline. So when we hear about these great kings who are completely surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we obtain a long life. We obtain wealth, good reputation, good fortune, and ultimately the opportunity to return back home, back to Godhead. So we've all gained that just by sitting and hearing from Srila Prabhupada's purports. So now we are entering the fifth canto. I'll take a few minutes and describe the fifth canto. In the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 10, text number 1, there is a listing of what are the 10 subject matters of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So it says, Atra, in this Bhagavatam, Sarga Visargascha, Sthanam Poshanam Utayaha, Manvantara Ishanukatha, Nirodham, Muktir, and Ashrayaha. These are the 10 subject matters. So they are, sarga means creation. This is where the topic of how the Supreme Personality of Godhead manifests the material energy. Visarga is sub-creation or secondary creation. How Lord Brahma takes all the material ingredients that have been created, the 24 elements that Lord Kapila explains, and puts them all together to create the 8,400,000 species, the entire planetary systems, all of that. That's Visarga. Sthanam means position, or how the different planetary systems are in relation to each other within the universe. Poshanam means to take care, how Krishna takes care of his devotees. Utaya means the creative impetus. The fifth canto is called the creative impetus. Creative impetus means, what is it that inspires people to do what they do? Generally, it's fruitive activities, fruitive mentality. That's the creative impetus. That's talked about here. Then Manvantara, the different lineages of the different Manus are discussed. Ishanukatha, discussions about the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Nirodham means the path for returning back home, back to Godhead. That's discussed. Muktir means liberation. And Ashraya means the Samam Bonam, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So these 10 subjects are discussed in the Bhagavatam. The Srimad Bhagavatam is also considered to be the literary incarnation of Krishna. So the first two cantos are called the Padapadma. They are the lotus feet of Krishna. Cantos 3 and 4 are the legs of Krishna. Canto 5 is the navel, is compared to like to be the navel of Krishna. Canto 6 is the chest of Krishna. 7 and 8 are his arms. Canto 9 is his beautiful neck. Canto 10 is his smiling face. Canto 11 is his broad forehead. And Canto 12 is his head. So these 12 cantos are like the literary form of Krishna. And we proceed from first canto all the way up. Like how we take darshan of Krishna, first thing we see is the lotus feet, and slowly appreciate the beautiful form of Krishna. As we see his navel, we appreciate how he's holding and sustaining all creation. When we see his chest, we feel very confident, because Krishna's chest can weather anything, even Bhrigu Muni's kick. Because one who is strong-chested can take any difficulty. Krishna can take anything. And for us, that's the prayer, because we also face many difficulties. When we look at Krishna's arms, our meditation is that we are feeling very protected by Krishna's arms. His beautiful neck, smiling face, forehead, etc. So we are at the beginning, the fifth canto. Now the fifth canto has 26 chapters. The first 15 chapters are part 1, and the next 11 chapters are part 2. So it has two sections, part 1, part 2. Part 1 has two sections. The first six chapters are about the life of Rishabdev. The next, or six, so now the nine chapters, the next nine chapters are the life of Bharat Maharaj. These two great kings who are descending from Priyavrata Maharaj. The fifth canto begins with Priyavrata. So in the first six chapters, we hear about Priyavrata, who was actually a brahmachari or a sannyasi, renounced, and he was forced to take on the position of Manu. Although he was not wanting to, there was a need for service. So one of the things to learn from this is that a devotee does whatever is needful, even if it is risky, but his risk was protected by Narada, Brahma and Swayambhuva Manu. So when he was assured of it, he took up the position of Manu, king. And so he has a child, he has many children, 10 children. One of them is Agnidra. Agnidra became a very, very qualified king. He was blessed by Lord Brahma to marry Purvachitti, a heavenly damsel. And through Purvachitti, he had the son, Nabhi. Nabhi married Meru Devi, and to them was born King Rishabdev. Because Nabhi was such a fantastic devotee that Lord Vishnu personally came to his fire sacrifice. How be nice, huh? We do a fire sacrifice and Lord Vishnu personally comes. He came and he promised him, "You're such an amazing devotee, I will come as your son." And that son was King Rishabdev. And Rishabdev, in his teachings to his 100 sons, the essential message was that life is not meant to be wasted. Life is meant to live according to the austerities of Bhakti Yoga principles and by serving great souls. That is the verse yesterday we were discussing. Mahatsevam dwara mahor vimuktes. That by serving great devotees, the door for complete liberation opens up. Then, one of the sons of Maharaj Rishabdev is Bharat Maharaj. They're very qualified sons. Some of them became fantastic householders. 9 of them became the Navayogendras, which we'll hear about in the 11th canto. And one of them was not the Navayogendras, one of the Grahasthas was Maharaj Bharat, after whom the whole planet was named Bharatvarsha. Then the three lives of Bharat are discussed in chapters 7 through 15. As a king, as a deer, and as Jada Bharat, as a complete retard. In the second section, chapters 16 through 19, this is where things get complicated. This is part 2. This is the geography of the Bhumandala. How the entire earthly realm, Bhumandala, is structured. There's a description specifically of the Sumeru Mountain in Jambudvipa, which we're all part of Jambudvipa. This is that section of Bhumandala that we are part of. There's a description of how the Ganges descended into Bhumandala. Remember the story of Vamana lifting his foot to cover the upper planetary systems? At that time, his toe pierced through the coverings of the universe and Ganges leaked in. So it's described how she comes to the Bhumandala through all the different planetary systems. And finally, there is a description about the prayers of the residents of Jambudvipa. Beautiful, beautiful prayers. They worship Lord Narasimhadev, and there's very nice descriptions. Then in chapters 20 through 26, there's a description of the 7 oceans and the 7 islands that these oceans surround in Bhumandala. There's a description of the lotus flower on which Lord Brahma sits, where he resides in the universe. He sits on a lotus that has 100 million petals. each made of pure gold. It's brilliant like the sun. It's described. It's called Hiranyagarbha, I think. Then there is description of the movements of the sun, how the sun traverses through the universe, giving light to and bringing about the karmic reactions of all the different living entities. Then there is description of what is called the Shishumara planetary system. Shishumara is the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead within this material structure. It is similar to the shape of a dolphin. And our entire universe is structured like that. So there's a description of this Shishumara. At the end of that description, it's said how the yogis sit down every day and they meditate on this form of the universe, where each planet or planetary system is located in relation to the tail of the dolphin, the fins of the dolphin, the nose of the dolphin, the eyes, etc. Beautiful description. Complicated, but it'd be nice. Then it talks about the lower planetary systems, especially the hellish realm. What happens for those persons that just live irresponsibly? What does the hellish planetary system do? How is it structured, etc.? Parikshit Maharaj asks Shukadev Goswami, can you please describe it? So he describes it. So those are the 26 chapters of 5th Canto. Two sections and four parts, if you will. So, any questions? Come, wow. She was first asked. I saw her. Oh, he has to leave for a train.
Thank you very much for your class. In the beginning, you were describing how...
You will be, which is true. So therefore I described, what is it, what is the Mangalarti for? What are we doing? We're coming in front of Sri Guru, both with gratitude, also regret that, oops, my bucket has many holes. I've lost the mercy that you gave. Please fill my heart with mercy, so I can carry on the day in jubilation, in joyful service with the mercy that you've given me. And if it's just ritual, then the Guru's pouring mercy here and we're holding the bucket there. Oh, got it, it's all right. Today I didn't get, tomorrow I can wake up and take. That's what makes it ritualistic. Or, okay, come on, fill it up. No, we're happy. We want that mercy. Because without that mercy, we're entering the realm of darkness again. That's the light, torchlight. And without that knowledge, without transcendental vision, it's the same thing that we were saved from. Have you ever had the experience that you're trying to help someone and they want to be in the same terrible condition? You will. We all have that experience. Maybe in different degrees of it. There's a pastime. One time Lord Brahma cursed Indra that you have such a mentality. Become a hog. So he became a hog. Then Lord Brahma went to him and told him, all right, enough of hog life, come back. The throne of heaven is waiting for you. the kingdom, the post of king of all the demigods waiting for you. And you know what he said? I'm very happy here. I like this. I'm comfortable here. So like that, Sri Guru or Krishna's mercy wants to take us to a better condition, but we're very happy with that. Very happy in what we're doing. The happiness is because there is darkness and we become accustomed to darkness. So I don't want to change anything. Manda sumanda mateo. So the ritualistic part is to not know why we're doing what we're doing. It's the opportunity, it's the morning opportunity to fill our heart with that joyous mercy. It's the satchit ananda part. That's what we're coming for. It's the ananda fill. Daily dose of ananda. If we lose out there, we don't have. Is that right? I spoke particularly in that language to not make it. I can give a more philosophical answer if you want, but what touches the heart is the real rasa part. Okay. Mother Kirtida?
Prabhu, I was wanting to hear more about cultivating that mood of gratitude.
Oh, I'm the wrong person.
No, I would like to hear more about cultivating the mood of gratitude.
Whatever I knew, I said. I don't know anything else. If we genuinely consider where we came from, feeling grateful is easier. Where we came from, what condition we were in. What is worse is we were happy in that condition. You understand what I'm saying? If one was suffering and was saved, then one might say, oh, I was, you know, like for example, I didn't have a job, everybody hated me, then I found the devotees and they gave me prasadam. That's nice, that one should be very grateful for that. But what if everything was seemingly really nice? That means one was happily heading towards darkness. Nice family, nice situation of life, everything was there. To be saved from that condition is, so the point is, every day, often, we should look at where we came from. Another way is, today whatever we have, where does it come from? What have we done to get whatever we have? Nothing, actually. It is said, right? The other day I heard Bhakta Luke talking to someone. We were sitting at the prasadam table. And this is what we hear. What does a son have to do to inherit the property of the father? Nothing. Just be a son. Doesn't even have to be nice to the father. Just being a son can inherit the property. So whatever we have, whatever ability, whatever skill, has all come because it has been invested in us. And when we forget that, when we deviate from feeling grateful, we will see, we have experience also, that all of those cannot be accessed. The so-called humility, the knowledge, all of that vanishes. In fact, it doesn't vanish. It's like we're separated from it by a glass wall. For example, in a situation that we are facing, we know that unless we are grateful, we cannot address that situation. In fact, any situation, unless we are grateful, we cannot address it. If for some reason that gratitude is covered by pride or something, lamentation, attachment, whatever, name your poison, then although we know, oh, I should be humble, I should be, we cannot access it. Because we don't feel it. So it's like a glass wall. We can see it. We can see all the things that we need, but we can't get them. It's your example that you gave Sunday night, having the bottle of honey, but licking the outside of it. It's the honey. It's there. It's in our hand. We're even licking the container, but not the honey. It's like that. It's a glass container that separates it from us. So feeling grateful, not just talking about it, feeling grateful every day is important, is necessary. So question is, how to feel grateful? Well, we consider. Consider everything in our life has come because it has been gifted by another Vaishnava, Guru, everything is coming because Krishna's mercy. Yeah, I'm waiting for you to say. Once you looked up means the next comment coming up.
So sometimes it can be that the gratitude may be there to some extent. The gratitude may be there. Of course, gratitude can always be improved on. But also sometimes one's, I guess you could say, material desires can override. Is it possible that it can override the gravity, the gratitude that one has?
It is possible. It is possible because, you know, Vaisheshika Prabhu's favorite, I'm not sure if it is his favorite, but something that he says often is, energy flows where attention goes. So that's where it's the issue. Wherever is our attention, that's what takes on life. If our attention is on material desires, if our attention is on our attachments, that's what grows. If our attention is on our gratitude, that's what grows. But
sometimes it could be like this, you know? Sometimes it's here and sometimes it's there.
That's right.
So it's like a...
So if you carefully observe what tilts the pan scale, you will notice it's wherever your attention is. Suddenly you feel, not you, when we feel, wow, so Krishna is so merciful, then this side tilts, because this side is now the heavier side. And then we put our, but I have that, you know, but if that situation, and that side tilts. It's wherever our attention goes. Another phrase we've heard about is where we invest our consciousness.
Okay.
You want to say more?
Yeah, one more question.
Okay.
So, you can laugh at this one if you want.
Can I what?
You can laugh at this one if
you
want.
Oh, sure, I will.
So is it, what about the idea of cultivating that gratitude, but also self-honesty, meaning, okay, well, this is where I'm at, so I want to feel this gratitude and I want to cultivate the gratitude because I know that's essential in my Krishna consciousness, but at the same time, understanding that we are in a certain place, and I know you can easily say, well, that's like the easy way out, well, I'm here, I'm conditioned like this, so therefore...
Okay.
So I don't mean it like that, but I mean it in the sense of being honest with ourselves as to where we actually are, because we all have certain material desires.
Sure.
And so it's easy to say, well, let me just focus on gratitude, and therefore the attention won't go to those material desires. But reality is that, at least for me anyway, that the material desires are there, and if I can focus on the gratitude, but still those material desires are there because I'm not on the platform where I can just put all of my energy and focus in gratitude, and so therefore everything else just takes a sideline. It's, I mean, at least...
So I'll repeat it, and you hear it. The way you described it, self-honesty means that it is okay to have mixed devotional service. Because I'm honest. Hey, I'm mixed. That's how it sounds. Okay, I know you don't mean that. I'm saying how it sounds. Self-honesty is honesty only to the degree of acknowledgement that I am not pure. That is called self-honesty. But I will act on what is not the pure part is not self-honesty. It is called weakness of heart. You understand? Otherwise, people in the name of self-honesty will say, I am not pure. And by the way, how many pure people do we meet? Very few. Rare. So while purity is rare, opportunity is for everyone. So self-honesty means, I'm not there, I'm here. Or here, wherever. And how do I take the next step towards purity? That is honest, self-honesty. We only talk of half the definition of self-honesty. Half the definition is, I'm here. As if that's that justifies, therefore I will head in this direction. Is that clear? Yeah. Okay. We generally self-honesty, we only see half the picture. In fact, the full picture is, because I'm somewhere here, not fully pure, I need to call upon the mercy with whatever capacity I have so that I can move in the direction of purity. That's honesty. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. So tomorrow we'll have fifth canto, first chapter, first verse.